Coming up, the impact of the recession on America's food banks, struggling to meet the increasing needs of the unemployed and the homeless.
It's people skipping meals, children going without food. It's hunger.
And are seminarians being adequately prepared to provide pastoral care on issues of sexuality?
When those folks are coming to us in faith communities for real information and for real help, we need to make sure we have the training to be able to address that.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're yourretirementcompany.com. Also by the Henry Luce Foundation and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Welcome, I'm Bob Abernethy. It's good to have you with us. Widespread criticism this past week of President Obama's proposal to cap tax deductions on charitable giving. Several philanthropic leaders said the change for the wealthiest benefactors would reduce giving, just as charities are grappling with losses because of the economic crisis. One study found that two-thirds of nonprofits are struggling to meet expenses. But the president defended his proposal at a press conference.
The most important thing that I can do for charitable giving is to fix the economy, to get banks lending again, to get businesses opening their doors again, to get people back to work again.
Among the recession's many victims, perhaps none have been more painfully hurt than those who find themselves not only out of work and perhaps homeless, but hungry as well. Money from the federal government stimulus package will help, but for now, in spite of generous volunteers, food banks say they're almost overwhelmed. Lucky Severson reports.
Attention in a shelter. We're now ready to start breakfast. Families with children at the beginning of the line.
What Americans don't want to hear right now is more bad news, but it shouldn't come as no surprise that so many of our neighbors and fellow citizens, more than one in ten of us, are either experiencing hunger or staring it in the face.
We're getting ready to sell the house because we're going to be going in foreclosure.
People like Shannon and Aaron simply can't hang on any longer.
Our payments are going up. Every 6 months they keep going up, and it's just we don't make enough to cover the mortgage and all the other necessities, you know, electric, gas, food.
If not for churches and charities manning the food banks and mobile pantries, many more would be hungry. If not for friendly volunteers, the ordeal of asking for a handout would be even more demeaning. This is the Roadrunner Food Bank in Albuquerque. It's funded almost exclusively from private and corporate donations, from companies like Costco, for instance. The food goes from here to over 600 outlets throughout New Mexico, the majority of them faith-based. It's an impressive operation. Roadrunner is a member of Feeding America, formerly known as Second Harvest, the country's largest hunger relief agency. Melody Wattenbarger is Roadrunner's executive director.
Food banks are sort of like the canaries in the mine shaft. You know, we've been saying for a long time that things were not going well, that families were struggling. The frustrating part is that the need has been going up 30 or 40%. I said yesterday, now we don't need canaries in the mine shaft anymore. Everybody knows how bad it is.
Feeding America gives food assistance to over 25 million Americans, 9 million are kids, 3 million seniors. The nonprofit supplies over 200 food banks in every state that in turn distribute to food pantries like this one in Riverhead, Long Island, managed by the Long Island Council of Churches. Reverend Tom Goodhue is executive director, and he's not happy.
We're more and more feeding people now who are employed full-time and can't make ends meet. It makes me angry, I got to tell you. To see hard-working people who are still employed full-time and are doing the best they can and can't make ends meet really, really makes me mad.
In New York City, nearly two-thirds of the food agencies haven't had enough supply to meet the demand. Many were forced to ration. Joel Berg is the executive director of the New York City Coalition Against Hunger.
Things had gone in the last few years from bad to worse. In the last year, things have really gone from worse to worser. That's horrible English, but that really describes what's happening.
A recent survey by Feeding America found that 3 out of 4 food pantries nationwide are faced with rationing food. This small outlet north of Albuquerque called People Helping People has had to close its doors on occasion. This is Chris Hoyle.
And you're really under siege right now, aren't you?
Yes, we are. Yes, we're struggling right now with our finances.
Because?
Because our donations are down and our numbers are extremely high.
We're probably looking at about 50, 60 families, new families, a month.
Yes, we're seeing a lot of people who have never come, and they're just in need now. They've hit at a place in their life where they've been laid off, they're in between jobs, and they simply need food.
People we've spoken with who feed the poor say this hard time stands above all others they could remember because of how deep it reaches and how widespread it is. They say an increasing number of people who were once donors themselves are now coming in for help. And they say that churches and charities can no longer feed all the Americans struggling with hunger.
The hunger situation in New Mexico is even worse than other parts of the country. Here, 1 in 6 adults can't put enough food on the table. 1 in 4 kids are hungry.
Almost half of the people being served by our mobile pantries are children. What we think is happening is that people are able to swallow their pride when their children are involved. And if there weren't children, they likely would just make do some kind of way.
Many feel that they are forgotten victims of circumstances beyond their control. Some are angry, but they don't quite know who to blame.
There are people making paychecks that are absolutely ridiculous. And there are people that are hungry. How do they sleep with their conscience? How do they do that? Obviously, I'd love to invite them here, see what the real world is like.
My heart really goes out to people on fixed incomes because there isn't anything they can do. They have so much pride, and they just will almost never seek help.
Near downtown Albuquerque, the St. Martin's Day Center and Soup Kitchen feeds about 400 people a day. Many of the clients here are chronically homeless. As many as 3 out of 4 have a mental or physical illness. These are not the people who lost jobs in the suburbs with huge chains like Circuit City and Linens and Things. Most here lost minimum wage jobs in places like fast food establishments. Some, like Lindsay Work, can't go back to work until they get medical care, which is way beyond their means.
I was a security officer for about the last 17 years, and I had a massive seizure working security at the state fair. And after that, I just lost everything.
Now he and his wife are sleeping in shelters.
You got to make the choice of either food, rent, or bills. You know, whatever keeps you safe.
Yeah.
And right now, it's the thing of food. You got to put food in your stomach.
Linda Woods Fuller is the director at St. Martin's, up against lagging donations and vastly increasing need.
We help with the near poor. You know, we don't just say homeless, because the near poor is that population is steadily increasing.
Here's the good news. People are less oblivious to the misery around them. They're helping more.
One of the great things that I think is happening in this recession is that people are much quicker to see that their neighbors are in the same boat that they are in. So there's been really a huge outpouring of generosity from people saying, I want to make sure my neighbors don't starve.
And some pastors report that more people are going to church and volunteering in food pantries like this one, sponsored by the Evangelical Church of Philadelphia in Albuquerque. Pastor Joe Romero.
Every time there's a crisis, and it seems like it gets desperate, and it's always at the end of the rope. And when people feel they're at the end of the rope, they start turning towards God, you know.
The bad news is the need is so great, all the churches and charities put together can't feed all the hungry.
Saying that we can end hunger with a few canned food drives, a problem that impacts 36.2 million Americans, a population larger than the state of California, just isn't true.
Berg says hunger costs the U.S. $90 billion a year in medical costs and lost productivity. A few years ago, the Department of Agriculture devised a new measurement called the Food Insecurity Index. It's very high in New Mexico. Melody Wattenbarger doesn't like the term. She says maybe if we called it what it is, we would treat it more seriously.
It is a cruel circumstance for people. And to call it other than what it really is, it's people skipping meals, children going without food, it's hunger.
According to Feeding America, the president's stimulus package will add $20 billion to help relieve hunger among America's families. It's by far the largest increase of its kind in history. This means a family of four, on average, should receive an additional $80 a month in food assistance for the next 3 years. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, I'm Lucky Severson in Albuquerque.
In other news, human rights groups are alleging several cases of abuse in the war between Israel and Hamas in Gaza earlier this year. The United Nations has condemned the conduct of both sides, but most of the criticism from UN officials and human rights observers has focused on Israel. At the same time, some Israeli soldiers said rabbis in the military encouraged troops to approach their assignment in Gaza as a religious war. Israeli officials said only a few rabbis were at fault and insisted the country was acting in self-defense. In the U.S., a federal judge in New York has ordered the Food and Drug Administration to relax restrictions on what's known as the morning-after pill, Plan B. The pill can prevent pregnancy if taken within 72 hours of intercourse. Some religious and socially conservative groups oppose its use because they consider Plan B a form of abortion or say it will increase promiscuity. In 2006, the FDA allowed over-the-counter sales for those 18 and older. The new court decision said the FDA must give 17-year-olds access to the drug and reconsider other limitations. The University of Notre Dame is embroiled in controversy over its plans to host President Obama as its commencement speaker. Conservative Catholic groups are protesting the choice because Obama supports abortion rights and therefore, they say, is an inappropriate speaker on a Catholic campus. The bishop, whose diocese includes Notre Dame, said he will boycott the speech, but Notre Dame is standing by its decision. Pope Benedict XVI returned to the Vatican this week from his 7-day visit to Africa, his first trip there as pope. News coverage of what happened in Africa was overshadowed by the controversy the Pope himself set off when he told reporters en route that the distribution of condoms in Africa makes the HIV/AIDS crisis there worse, not better. Here to review the Pope's trip is Kevin Ekstrom, the editor of Religion News Service. Kevin, welcome.
Thanks.
What happened?
Well, there was, I think, two trips in one here. There was the trip that happened on the ground, where the Pope went to meet his flock in Africa, which was, for the most part, pretty successful. But the other trip that we saw was the one that was overshadowed by the controversy on the condom comments. That story is a week later. We're still talking about it. That sort of overshadowed everything else they talked about.
He seems to have a tendency to say things that seem to us unnecessarily controversial. True?
There is a tendency, rightly or wrongly, that this Vatican is a little tone deaf on how things are going to come across. Mm-hmm. It makes total sense to them, and their positions are very well thought out. But how it's received by everyone else, there's a big gap there.
But this condom thing, that was not an accident. I mean, all questions for the Pope on his plane must be submitted in advance in writing, so he knew what he was going to be asked.
Exactly. I mean, they knew exactly what they were getting into on this one, and it always makes you wonder if they were actually trying to make some news out of this. The Pope's trip to Africa was news before he even landed in Cameroon.
But it was, as you said, very successful. He encouraged the Catholics in Africa.
Right. I mean, this is a growing, thriving part of the church that the Pope sort of wanted to see and almost needs to see. He's been decrying this dictatorship of relativism in Europe, in sort of an anemic church. And you go to Africa, and they can't fit enough people into the churches. They can't ordain enough pastors for all the people. It's a rapidly growing part of the church. And I think there's a bit of an energy boost for both sides there.
Mm-hmm. And competition with Islam there, too. Huh?
Right. In Cameroon, for example, his first stop, one out of every four people is Muslim, and only half the population is Christian. And they're both fighting nonviolently, of course, mm-hmm. for souls in that area of the world.
And that is now the center of Christianity in the world, isn't it?
Right. The balance of power has shifted from the largely Christian North to the rapidly growing South. Mm.
Kevin Ekstrom of Religion News Service, many thanks.
You're welcome.
Now, a special report on teaching about sex and gender issues in theological seminaries, or really not teaching about them, sexual problems in marriage, gay, lesbian, and transgender questions, kids having sex at ever younger ages. Some religious leaders are concerned that many seminarians are not being taught what they need to know to become good counselors to their future parishioners. Judy Valente reports.
Sex and sexuality, of course, is a very significant part of our experience. And I put the question up here, is sex divine?
Professor Laurel Schneider of Chicago Theological Seminary teaches an evening course in systematic theology. Most of the time, it's hardly sexy stuff. But this evening, the topic is sex. This seminary is one of the few where human sexuality, in all its facets, is openly discussed.
My oldest son right now won't even talk to me, won't even have anything to do with me. His comment to me was, God created you as a man, and God does not make mistakes.
The male who wants to become a female, that part of you inside that wants, that feels female and wants to become a female, that's still a part of you. That's still, God made that too.
One man, one woman, let the people vote.
Sexual mores have been changing. But how well are seminaries preparing future pastors and rabbis to address these changes?
The Religious Institute on Sexual Morality is a nonprofit group that helps promote sexual health in faith communities. The Institute recently studied 36 seminaries across denominational lines. The study found an overwhelming need to better educate and prepare future religious leaders in the area of human sexuality.
We see these issues every day, and the harm that can be done around sexuality issues, either a kid who's questioning their orientation, a couple whose marriage is failing. I think when those folks are coming to us in faith communities for real information and for real help, we need to make sure we have the training to be able to address that.
Many pastors say issues such as teen sexual activity and marital infidelity are among the most common topics about which congregation members seek guidance. Yet few seminaries offer courses in sexuality, and fewer still require these courses.
It's a challenge. It's controversial. It makes people feel uncomfortable. It makes people feel insecure. So it's just taking time for schools to come on board with addressing those issues.
When seminaries don't offer the courses, they're still talking about the issue. They're just talking about it from silence and from a negative perspective. And seminary students understand that. They hear both messages loud and clear, and we would just prefer that they get a positive, open message rather than a silenced or dismissive message.
Some clergy have criticized the Religious Institute's report, saying seminaries can't teach everything, that students aren't there primarily to obtain how-to skills, but to study biblical texts, to reflect and pray. Dr. Hunt says it's a legitimate point.
You have to then change your whole curriculum. If you want to incorporate issues of human sexuality and race and gender, you have to examine everything you're teaching in your educational context, and that's a lot of hard work.
As a result, graduating seminarians are often expected to learn on the job.
Bless those in this ministry and our church.
Reverend Lillian Daniel is the senior pastor of First Congregational United Church of Christ in Glen Ellyn, Illinois. She recalls one of the few classes at her divinity school where sex was discussed.
The teacher goes, never, ever, ever with anyone in your congregation. We all thought,
did we miss the verb? You know, what is it, go skiing, go dancing? I mean, he couldn't even bring himself to say the word. And that was the extent of the conversation.
And the word would have been,
don't sleep with.
Daniel says seminaries often discuss gender rights, sexual harassment, and how pastors should maintain proper boundaries with their congregation members. But, she says, they rarely train students to deal with the complex, intimate questions congregation members are likely to bring to them.
We don't have as much sex as he wants, and we have more sex than I want, and we'll never fix this. That's a very, very common issue between couples.
As part of a Sunday afternoon series on sexuality, Daniel's congregation has been examining a variety of issues connected with marriage.
Sexuality isn't bad. It's something it's a good thing. It's a gift from God, which is the cliche, but it is a gift from God. And to deal with it honestly and openly is very, very important, I think, to a lot of people here.
I'm all in favor of referring people on to folks with more expertise if they've got sort of issues that are ongoing. But a lot of times people come in to see a pastor because they want to tell something one time, or they just want a reality check, or they just want some kind of comfort or someone to listen to them. Sometimes it's almost in the air of a confession. And so in those cases, we may be their only stop.
Chicago Theological, a United Church of Christ seminary, received a high rating in the Religious Institute study. But even this school doesn't require students to study human sexuality. It does, however, offer several sexuality courses. Alice Hunt says the seminary wants its graduates to be able to minister to the whole person.
Understanding what your tradition says about human sexuality, being sexually healthy yourself, understanding what religious texts say, being aware of counseling issues, knowing how human development happens with sexuality, being aware of societal constraints and the fear that people face for not being able to fully express who they are. All of those are crucial in becoming a mature minister.
The problem is it really falls upon the pastor to seek out that knowledge. And if you were somebody who wanted to shut yourself away from this, you really could. And your church could become a place where none of this is able to be talked about.
But there does seem to be a shift in generational attitudes. Today's young seminarians, who grew up in a more sexually liberal culture, seem eager to address these matters openly.
I think that generally speaking, younger folks tend to see, for instance, homosexuality is basically a non-issue, whereas older folks come from a different time and a different place where you weren't as open about sex and sexuality. And I think that I would include heterosexuality in that as well as homosexuality, as you alluded to in the question, in terms of cohabitation for heterosexual couples. I think, generally speaking, we are in a more non-judgmental time, and I consider that a very good thing.
Many pastors would disagree. Nonetheless, questions of gay marriage and whether to ordain gay clergy have moved sexuality issues to the forefront in many churches. Alice Hunt says there's a far more fundamental reason for making sex a topic of discussion.
I hope another imperative is the imperative of God's love, a kind of radical inclusivity of everything that promotes human flourishing. I hope we'll take a good look at what we need to do to get to the space where we can fully minister to our congregation.
Our sexuality is part of our spirituality. We're embodied beings, and most of our faith traditions believe that God gave us a gift of sexuality. So it has deep theological meaning for us. So I don't think we can say sexuality isn't a religious issue. It deeply is a religious issue.
The Religious Institute recently received a grant to help seminaries introduce sexuality courses and provide continuing education classes for those already in ministry. One young seminarian described this as a coming out time for sexuality discussions in faith communities. If sex is a common topic in the Bible, he asked, then why shouldn't it be talked about in churches and seminaries? For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, I'm Judy Valente in Chicago.
Finally, the Greek Orthodox Patriarch Demetrios was at the White House this week celebrating Greek Independence Day, asking President Obama for help in solving some of Greece's problems, and then comparing Obama to the 4th century B.C. Greek hero Alexander the Great. Watch the president's reaction.
We are confident, Mr. President, that you, following the brilliant example of Alexander the Great, you will be able to...
That's our program for now. I'm Bob Abernethy. There's much more on our website. Audio and video podcasts are also available. Join us at pbs.org.